Nearly 50 years ago, black students and community members pushed the University of Illinois to recruit more black students and provide better resources. Today, a new generation says there's still much that needs to be done. Plus, a new health clinic just opened yesterday in Lincoln aims to shorten wait times and increase access to affordable medical and dental care in central Illinois. And the Urbana-based Jupiter String Quartet joins us in studio to give us a preview of their performance tonight at the Kranich Center for the Performing Arts.
I think audiences, when you see chamber music live, you really pick up on the way we're interacting on the stage. Unfortunately, we can't bring the volume that an orchestra brings, but I think we bring intimacy and dynamic communication.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. How would life at the University of Illinois change if the state's largest school admitted 1,000 black students a year instead of the 548 freshmen that were admitted last fall? That's the idea behind Project 1000. Members of the Black United Front UIUC have launched the project, which, among other things, calls for 1,000 black freshmen to be admitted to the U of I every year starting in 2020. The idea actually stems from a project decades ago. Some of you might remember Project 500. In 1968, black students and community members at the U of I told the administration they weren't doing enough to enroll more black students. It was part of a larger effort to provide more equality on campus, and it was commonly known as Project 500 for the goal of enrolling 500 black freshmen per year. Almost 50 years on, organizers say enough hasn't been done. I'm joined now in studio by two of those organizers with the Black United Front. Sunny Teray is a graduate student at the U of I studying black history. Akeisha Lee is a senior at the U of I. She's studying psychology and community health. Sunny, Akeisha, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Hey, thank you for having us. Thank you.
Sunny, let me start with you. What do you think life would look like at U of I if the school enrolled 1,000 black freshmen every year?
Well, life from the perspective of black students would be totally transformed. To walk around campus and have even double the amount of black students that we have right now would be very transformative for us, for every single black student I've ever spoken to about the issue. But even beyond that, to have that many black students at this campus would also transform the entire culture of the university, the entire culture of this area. It would go a long way towards doing that. And definitely the equitable representation of black students would definitely do that. Because we have to remember, Project 1000 is not even seeking equitable representation just yet. You know, even Project 1000 going on for a whole decade wouldn't get us to, you know, the 17.3%, which we are of Illinois public schools.
Okay. Akeisha, can you explain that, the equitable representation, what Sunny's talking about? So when you say 17%, that's the current reflection of what it looks like across the public school system across the state?
Mm-hmm. So in grades K through 12, we are 17.3% of the population of those schools, but we're only 5.1% of our representation here at U of I. So the question is, where are those students going? Why do they feel like U of I, their state school, isn't where they should be?
And the largest school, obviously the largest university in the state, mm-hmm. Sets a lot of, you know, which has a lot of meaning, I know, for you guys too, as students here. Sunny, I mentioned Project 500 just a minute ago and the efforts that were made in the 60s and 70s to enroll more black students, provide better resources, because obviously we know, and I want to talk about with these you guys, it's not just about admitting students, it's also about keeping those students enrolled and successfully graduating students,
right,
and creating a culture for that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How does Project 1000 build on Project 500 and how is it different?
That's a great question. I'm very happy you asked me that question. I would say it builds on it because it corrects a lot of the mistakes and shortcomings that Project 500 and the student organization who took a large part in carrying that out, the Black Student Association, it really corrects a lot of those mistakes. One thing that BSA was able to do with Project 500, and we also have to remember that Project 500 was a university administrative program. The day before the administration announced Project 500, the black students, the BSA, they announced that they wanted 600 black students to be brought to this university. And also that same day, they announced a protest, a rally to take place the next day. And
this is back in 68.
Oh, this is back in 1968.
Okay.
This is back in 1968, and it took place right after Dr. King was assassinated. So I say racial tension, but I mean the white supremacy, the racism of the white population here, of the whole country, was at such a large amount that, it forced the issue, you know. So even Project 500 is a step down. That's the point I'm trying to make, is a step down from the black student demand. So we're changing it up because the black students then were not able to, achieve any level of power to see to it that change of culture was actually realized. You know, it's easy in this society to attain the influence to get something symbolic passed. And that's exactly what Project 500 was. It was a hollow symbolic project that this university administration put on. So Project 1000 is actually a student-led, a student-controlled movement campaign to change the culture, to change the reality here, and to bring more black students here.
Sunny, you're a graduate student. Akeisha, you're an undergraduate
yes.
student. Can you explain a little bit more about Black United Front here at the University of Illinois? Is it an effort of both the undergraduate and graduate student population?
Mm-hmm. It is. It's made up of a lot of different representations from the university. So we have graduate students, we have undergraduate students, and we're also driving to get community members involved in our program. And the whole point is that we can come together as organizers representing just black students in general and help us to improve our status here at the university.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you, Akeisha, because when mm-hmm. you say 1,000 black freshmen, mm-hmm. of course, it actually means the university needs to admit more than 1,000 because you want 1,000 enrollees. And so you're going to need, obviously, a bigger number of that than people who will actually commit, right? So what do you think needs to change in terms of recruiting black students from a university standpoint?
Okay. I think one of the main things is that black students in the community don't see U of I as obtainable for them based upon lack of funding and lack of resources for black students here. When they come here, black students aren't readily available to tell them about their placement here at the university. And a lot of students feel like, okay, we're on the brochures, but where's our true purpose in the university? So we don't have enough funding for our Afro department. We don't have enough funding for our black houses. We don't have enough funding for our recruitment to CPS schooling. And that's the main issue we have. So the university can improve upon those things.
And you're a product of CPS schooling. You came here from Chicago?
So I actually went to a private school.
Ah,
yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you went to a private school in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What was your path to U of I? Why did you choose to come here?
So from Marian Catholic, which is a predominantly white school, they brought people to recruit those white students. I just happened to be there. It was a white recruiter. They were looking for people like me to come to the school, in my opinion. They couldn't tell me about black resources that are available to me. They were just like, well, you have the GPA. Please come to our school. And that's basically all I really got from my recruitment experience. And then, that's all I got.
And Sunny, what about you? I mean, you chose to come here for graduate school. You're from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose to come to the University of Illinois?
Yeah, I was. What helped me choose this university is I had a relationship with my mentor from my previous university, my undergraduate university, who had came through this program and had recommended it to me. And after meeting some of the black scholars that attend or that work here, I was drawn toward it and applied.
And what kind of when we think about, we were just talking about sort of admissions and the culture, there's a lot in here, right? So I wonder if we could talk about both of you, if you could kind of compare your experiences here as students and share sort of what you think, what kind of culture, do you believe there's a culture on campus at the University of Illinois that encourages and helps retain black students?
Yeah, I would say that, that culture might exist on campus, but it's at such a small scale. Well, I should say that it's at such a small scale compared to where it could be, it should be. So at this moment in time, I think that, I should say this. One of the biggest things that, you know, leads me and inspires me to, you know, contribute my energy towards Project 1000 is the idea that with this redistribution of resources and commitment from the university that we're trying to demand, it's a reform that we're demanding, it will make the black student community, the black campus community here stronger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the black campus community is stronger, we will do better with or without white racism, with or without a change in the white student body. Because I'm not even taking this project up hoping to change the white student body's mind and make them less racist. I just want to make the black student, the black campus community stronger so we can just, advance and progress that way.
Akeisha, can you explain? So one of the things is to have 1,000 admitted black freshmen. That's not immediately, right? Because that's 2020. Mm-hmm. Can you explain sort of the buildup first, just from the numbers perspective, and then let's talk about the other things that you all would like to see?
Sure.
Sunny, you want to, you're going to give them the numbers?
Yeah, okay. The numbers. Mm-hmm. So the plan starts with this first year.
I think the first year starts with...
So it's 500 this fall, right? Mm-hmm. Building up to then 650, then mm-hmm. 800, mm-hmm. then 1,000. So this year you're hoping for 500 enrolled black students.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. I do know we did reach out to the university, and I know they said that for the fall of 2017, they admitted 1,166 African-American students. Now that's admitted... that's a different number from enrollees, and I assume that includes graduate students and well. What do you feel like you would like to see from the administration in terms of, we talked about recruiting. You said you'd like to see more recruiting efforts within CPS. Mm-hmm. Akeisha, what else would you like to see?
So more recruitment within also Champaign-Urbana area, because this is really like their school they can come to. But I think the recruitment to like Central High School, which is high school around here in Champaign-Urbana High, is lacking. From within the own town. And I'd like to see also more scholarship programs for students already admitted. We have a plan to implement a 5-year program for our students, because oftentimes black students need that 5th year and their tuition will be able to be like frozen at that point. And we would like to have the school support that initiative.
So a scholarship program as mm-hmm. well. Okay. What else, Sunny?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, with this redistribution, what we're looking for is just as far as how it affects recruitment. I would say that it affects it by, you know, if the university applied the same type of energy applies toward maybe bringing Obama here to, you know, speak at the ceremony at the end of the semester, if it applied that same energy toward, you know, a fundraising or recruitment campaign for black students in this state, it would find success. If the university made a very holistic commitment to black student recruitment and retention the way it does for other things like medical facilities and things like that, then we would have it. We could do it. You know, the change in culture has to be from the top to the bottom. If President Killeen and Chancellor Jones were committed to black student recruitment and retention as much as they could be and should be, then we will be successful.
We did get a statement from the Associate Chancellor from Diversity, who says that we reached out to them before you guys were going to come on air. This is from Asada Zarai. And she said, in regards to the student group, Black United Front, the campaign to increase the number of and support for African-American students on the campus. This is what she said. Campus leaders are sympathetic to their goals, and we share their vision of a more diverse and inclusive institution. While we've made measurable progress in recent years, we agree that there remains much work to be done. And they said, we want to be clear each time the group has reached out to Chancellor Jones, Interim Provost Wilkin, Associate Chancellor Zarai, requesting a public forum. We've responded promptly and offered to meet with them. We welcome their input and energy to help advance our diversity efforts.
I can respond to that directly because we emailed them, asked them for a public town hall style meeting so we can get away from the private meetings where they can control the dynamics of the meeting, where they can control their participation and whatnot. We asked for a public meeting so we can get the whole campus community involved in this conversation. Now, we will agree to a private meeting to discuss.
So you guys haven't had a private meeting yet?
We'll agree to a private meeting to discuss the logistics for the public meeting.
Okay.
And that's about it.
Right. And now you guys also protested during the most recent Board of Trustees meeting last month.
Yes.
What was the goal with that, Akeisha?
So the goal was basically to put a little bit of pressure on the administration, because the whole thing was about diversity and inclusion. We feel that isn't being maintained here or promoted here at all. And we wanted to show them that we are here and we're ready to put the initiative forward. We want their support publicly.
And just to respond directly again to the university, the administration's current efforts, mm-hmm. we hold no hope that the administration left to its own devices will get 1,000 black students enrolled here per semester by 2020. There's no way it's going to happen. If we look at the past 4 or 5 decades, We see their history. We see how this is going to turn out if the university administration is left up to its own devices. So Dr. Asada Zarai, Chancellor Jones, President Killeen, I just feel like those sentiments are just, they're hollow. You know what I'm saying? They're hollow.
So what would you like the administration to do to put more action behind that, to make that a more substantial effort, to your point, Sunny?
I would say trust your Black students. Trust your student body. They always tell us, oh, the students are the ones that have the power, right? Okay, well, trust the students have the power, and trust we have the intellect to devise a program, which we've done, to see to it that this campus community is transformed for the positive, for the benefit of everybody here. You know, and we have a program that does that.
So the program is kind of a step up of admitted students, more recruiting, not just in Chicago, but across the public school system. You know, there's been an effort in the legislature to talk about, I wonder how you guys feel about that. There's been a state house effort to admit, I think it's the top 10%. Of class, have those students sort of automatically admitted into the University of Illinois. Do you guys think that would help?
I really wonder if the university fully support that. Because that was already in place in other states and they support it. But yes, they want to admit the top 10% of Whitney Young, but they also admit the top 10% of a Finger, and that'd be the same thing. I feel there'd be some pushback against that initiative.
Oh, yeah. I think the administration has already pushed back against that initiative. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've seen the successes. And I have to give a measure. When I say the successes of Texas, you know, having this initiative in place for a couple decades now, you know, of course, the public education system in Texas is not ideal. But, you know, with this top 10%, it does have some benefits. And it definitely would help us in Illinois get those numbers. And it would also be that symbolic showing to the Illinois student body that, yo, we want you to come here. And, you know, with nearly 20% of the Illinois public school system being Black, that would be a great sign for those Black students in Illinois public school systems to, you know, yo, come to University of Illinois. We want you. But, you know, the administration don't want that top 10%.
So last quick question for you guys, just to get clarity. So you all are in conversation with administration officials. I know originally you had asked for a public meeting by this Friday. Is that going to happen?
Where we're at right now, and there's still a lot of discussions going on.
Okay, so we're at that. Okay, we'll have to leave it at that. Okay. Thanks so much for joining us. Listening to the 21st, thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new health clinic has just opened in Lincoln, about 30 miles northeast of Springfield in central Illinois. One third of the residents in the clinic's target territory are at less than 200% of the federal poverty level. It's about 10,000 people, and this new clinic aims to increase access for them and shorten wait times, whether that's for medical, behavioral health, or dental care in the region. To learn more about all of this, I'm joined now on the line from Lincoln by Don Coffey, administrator of the Logan County Department of Public Health. Also on the line with us, Iris Wesley is chief executive officer of Southern Illinois University's Center for Family Medicine in Springfield. Don, Iris, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
We're pleased to be on.
Don, can you help us first understand the need for a clinic like this one in your part of central Illinois?
Yeah, we are. Well, first of all, let me backtrack. I've been administrator here only for a couple of years, but it didn't take long to see, you know, we have a real need for dental services in this area. And we were the only dental provider in Logan County that served Medicaid patients. And so I did some more research and I looked into our population, and you know, we have close to 14% of the population lives at the poverty level. And I further researched that we have a professional shortage of dentists and primary care physicians in the area. In addition, you know, the area is medically underserved. The doctors we currently have are extremely busy right now. So, you know, that got me thinking about this.
Yeah, when you say underserved, Don, what do you mean? Like, how long do people have to wait to see a doctor?
Well, I can give you an example for our dental clinic, which is now SIU's. But we had about a 6 to 8 month waiting period for our patients. When they were in the books, they had to wait quite a while to get into the clinic.
So 6 to 8 months to see a dentist.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Iris, is that what made you all want to choose this location for the clinic?
Yes, absolutely. Don actually partnered with Abraham Lincoln Memorial Hospital and said, hey, you know, we really need to get a clinic in this area. And, of course, the Home Memorial Health System, we've been partners with them in Springfield and in Jacksonville. And now this made sense for us to partner with them in Lincoln and help the underserved in that area.
And Don was talking, Iris, about dental care. And I know that Medicaid reimbursement rates in Illinois are particularly low when we think about dental care. Will this clinic help qualify for more Medicaid funding for dental care?
Yes, absolutely. An FQHC, or Federally Qualified Health Center, and that's also synonymous with community health center. We actually get a grant from the federal government, and unless you don't meet the requirements, that's in perpetuity. So we get the grant, and that helps us sustain it. We also get cost-based reimbursement for both medical and dental. So where Don probably got about $50 a visit for a dental patient, we will get upwards of maybe $100 a visit. That'll help us sustain it going into the future and add other services. And the real exciting thing that we're excited about is actually integrating oral and medical and also behavioral health there. We'll have all three in the same place so families can come and kind of do one-stop shopping.
You know, Iris, so what does that mean? So there'll be dental care, there'll be medical care, and you said behavioral health. What will that include?
That will include a licensed clinical social worker that will help folks kind of navigate behavioral health and also wellness coaching. We're integrating our behavioral health within the medical clinic. So they're right there with the physician or the nurse practitioner seeing the patient at the time. And anything that would come up, we can have them just go right in and see the patient at the medical visit. They don't have to come back. They don't have to make a separate appointment. So, and the same thing with oral health. If we see a child for a school physical and we notice, hey, have you seen the dentist lately? No, and we just send them over to the other side of the clinic and have them get their dental done there as well.
Don, I wonder if you can help us understand, as Iris is explaining, with this clinic that just opened yesterday will provide previously from the perspective of patients on Medicaid, what were the unique challenges and what unique challenges still exist to being in this part of central Illinois? I'm thinking Lincoln, just literally right smack in the middle of the state. What are the challenges in that part of central Illinois for having access to medical care right now?
Well, you know, being rural, there's just not as many centers available to serve these clients, and that in itself is a major challenge. And I know Iris hit a great point. And the thing that really prompted us is, you know, we were only, for the dental clinic, we were only getting, you know, $25 to $50 for doing things like basic teeth cleaning because we were billing the state for Medicaid. And that's really what prompted me to say, you know, let's take a look at an FQHC and let's look at partnering. And we're just grateful that, you know, they'll be able to sustain a dental clinic in this community because, you know, the need is so great. And I think it's just the fact that, you know, there's a limited number of providers that, you know, people downstate in central Illinois, it's, you know, you don't have as many options. And so this is going to be great for the community because, you know, one of the initiatives for public health is to promote an environment where access to care is great for everybody. And this is going to certainly provide an outstanding opportunity for people to have quality to affordable access, affordable health care. So we're really excited about it.
And Don, I think everybody who's listening is probably wondering about the state and state funding right now. And I'm thinking in particular of just one county over from you all in DeWitt County. The Human Resources Center had to close their doors last year because of the state budget impasse and the lack of funding. They were the only licensed addiction treatment facility in their region. And I wonder, when you think about that one county shutting down, how much does that put pressure on neighboring counties? And how is the ongoing state budget further increase the need for a clinic like yours?
Oh, absolutely. I hear things all the time about other counties and what they're going through, and we're certainly having our struggles. You know, right now, the state of Illinois, we have two programs that through a court order they were supposed to pay us, and they still owe us about $120,000.
And that's from court order money that's supposed to be coming to you.
Correct. It's for our HealthWorks and our Family Case Management program. It's very concerning. And then in addition, you know, the grants that we're supposed to provide for the community these public health grants. We're not getting the funding for that. So, you know, obviously I have to keep a real close eye on our dollars. And, you know, the great thing about this this partnership with SIU and with Abraham Lincoln Memorial Hospital is that we're going to have a referral process going here where we're going to find patients that come to our public health clinic, and we'll be able to refer clients to SIU. But on the other hand, SIU, they'll have clients that require our services, such as immunizations. And we feel that, you know, with the current state of finance that Illinois is in and the local health departments, we're looking for other revenue avenues. So we feel, you know, this will certainly be a tremendous boost for us, and I'm sure for SIU as well.
Iris, from the SIU perspective, I understand this clinic is being supported by a couple of different federal grants. We just have about a minute or two left, but I wonder if you can help us understand the business side of this. What needs to happen in order to make a clinic like this sustainable after grant funding runs out?
Well, the grant, that's the nice thing. The grant funding does not run out.
Great. That's good to
know. It comes back every year. We get an award for 3 years, and then we turn in a progress report, and as long as we were meeting all our requirements, it is renewed each year. So that helps us sustain it. And then, of course, the cost-based reimbursement that we get through Medicaid and Medicare helps us as well. So with that, and the other thing is that it's really nice is we get medication assistance for people. So we're part of the 340B drug program. So between all of that, we're able to see patients who don't have insurance, try to get them on some type of insurance, and that makes it all pretty sustainable with the grant and the cost-based reimbursement.
And so it sounds like, Iris, a lot of this funding is apart from the state situation, so it's a little more stable?
It is. Okay. It is. It's much more stable. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But and then I guess to the point that I was making to Dawn earlier, do you see an increased need for services anyway? How much pressure will that put on you guys?
Well, right now, you know, we started off this week, and we've had full days so far, so we're hoping to add providers. So, yeah, it's a little bit of pressure. But as long as, you know, people come to see us and we have the patients there, we should be able to maintain and expand.
Okay. So that's Iris Wesley. She's Chief Executive Officer of SIU's Center for Family Medicine in Springfield. I want to thank also Don Covey, Administrator of the Logan County Department of Public Health. So this clinic opened yesterday, right? So
yes.
You're open for business now. We'll tweet out all the information for people who are in Central Illinois who are interested in learning more about that. Don, Iris, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's Schumann Quartet No. 3, the first movement performed by the Jupiter String Quartet. They've called Illinois their home for the past 5 years. They performed all over the world, but are artists in residence at the University of Illinois, and they're performing tonight in Urbana at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts, and they're with me in studio to give us a preview and have a conversation. I'm joined now by violinist Nelson Lee and Meg Freivogel, violist Liz Freivogel, and cellist Daniel McDonough. Together, they formed the Jupiter String Quartet. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So watching you all play together, I wonder when you first started, did you all intend to come together as a quartet that's been together for now for more than a decade?
It's hard to say. I mean, we first started playing together and we really enjoyed it. But I don't think any of us really envisioned that it would last this long, I guess. Not that it's been that long. It's felt like a breeze, but... it's been about 15 years,
yeah.
So I don't know if we necessarily envisioned that.
And as young musicians, did you intend to pursue a career in music full-time?
Yeah, at the point
when we became a group, we all had committed to, well, some of us were in conservatory, some of us were in music school, and so we didn't know exactly which path it would take in music, but I think all of us wanted to have something to do within classical music. And we had strong backgrounds in chamber music and had played with a lot of different people at that point and gone to summer music festivals together. And that's actually why the first time we got together, we were making a recording to go to a summer music festival. And it was a great one in Vermont called Yellow Barn. And that set us off on a certain foot. And so one thing happened after another. But the original thought was that we go to the summer music festival and kind of see what happened.
And 15 years later,
yeah.
You guys are. My guests are Nelson Lee, Meg Freivogel, Daniel McDonough, and Liz Freivogel. Together, they are the Jupiter String Quartet. They're going to be performing tonight in Urbana at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. And they're in studio with me now, giving us a little preview of their performance. What's this piece going to be?
This is a Dvorak Cyprus, which Dvorak wrote these little love songs when he was quite young. He was in love with a young girl, and he never actually published them, and they were later revised for string quartet. So they're really just little love songs for string quartet.
That's the Jupiter String Quartet performing Dvorak's Cyprus No. 3 in studio. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and hear more music. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In studio with me, the Jupiter String Quartet. Let's hear another selection, Dvorak's Cyprus number 12. You're listening to the Jupiter String Quartet. They're in studio with me. They're actually performing tonight in Urbana at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. They're giving us a little preview of the performance. Nelson, Meg, Liz, and Daniel are in studio with me. How did you guys choose the name Jupiter?
I'll take it.
Nelson's going to answer
that. We all kind of looked at each other. When we formed, it was early 2002, Jupiter was very bright in the sky, so we liked the symbolism of that. And then we liked that there were a lot of musical references, for instance, Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, and Jupiter from the Planets by Holst is a very positive, powerful movement. And then something that we found out actually after we picked the name, we must admit, is that the astrological symbol for Jupiter kind of looks like a four, is in the shape of a four. So that seems...
So everyone thought you picked it because of that.
Right, yeah. So, but...
I do get embarrassed because I think some people think we picked it because it's like the king of the gods or the biggest planet. We weren't thinking about that at all.
Okay,
we were
so
thinking of these
disclaimer.
Connotations of joy and just the fact that it was the brightest planet in the sky. But later on, you know, people referred to that like somehow we thought, you know, it was the most special or something, but it wasn't that at all.
So you all play all over the world. I wonder, do you have different, do different audiences react to you differently depending on where you are?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if it's so much by geography how they react, but there always is a different vibe every time you play in a hall. You can feel really the energy of the audience, and actually it can make our job a lot harder or easier. Depending on whether we feel they're right with us, you know, focused, enthusiastic. I actually don't mind if people are kind of louder or rowdy as long as they're enthusiastic. My pet peeve is when you go and people feel, I think, inhibited or shy. You know, they think they have to be super polite and...
They think we're at a quartet, we have to behave.
Yeah, that part
yes.
I don't like. So champagne. I'm always happy when I, you know, when there's more energy out there. But I don't know if certain audiences
can really surprise you. I mean, you could be in the smallest town and there's this very strong chamber music community, and and people are there, and they know a lot about it. And you know, it's really surprising. It makes you want to get up on stage and play the best you can and communicate, you know, the music in the best way possible, you know, no matter where you are.
Yeah, I think actually sometimes in the places where they have fewer concerts, they're more appreciative of it because it's a really special thing for them. So, you know, sometimes places where you wouldn't think people would be the most sophisticated audience, but they are actually really into it.
We did once play in London. It was for a competition, but the competition kind of happened in a recital format. So there was an audience, and actually Daniel's mom was on that trip, and it was the quietest audience ever. She said she coughed and someone glared at her.
You know, it was very disapproving.
You could hear a pin drop. You know, which
for people, you guys, do you feel stifled then when people are doing that?
I mean, we already were probably nervous because it was a competition, but yeah. It's like you're super sensitive at that moment.
I mean, I appreciate the silence. I just don't want people to feel inhibited when they're watching.
What is it you think about chamber music as opposed to music for an entire orchestra that you feel like makes it so powerful?
I think it's the intimacy and the communication. The way we share musical lines with each other or pass motives back and forth. I think audiences, when you see chamber music live, you really pick up on the way we're interacting on the stage that you might not get with an orchestra. Unfortunately, we can't bring the volume that an orchestra brings, but I think we bring intimacy and dynamic communication.
So, Liz, it's interesting, as I was watching all of you, all four of you play, I was thinking about the pieces that you are playing for us are varied, the pieces you're going to be playing this evening. I wonder how you guys think about what you're assembling together when you're thinking about putting together a selection. Is it sort of this inevitable, like we want sort of the pieces that you think everyone is used to hearing versus pieces that maybe you all really love playing? How do you, and maybe I don't know how you all approach that balance. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of factors. I mean, part of it is choosing pieces that we think fit well together. So, for example, tonight's program, it sort of centers around this idea of love. So there's the Dvorak love songs. There's this Janacek quartet, which is subtitled Intimate Letters, which was inspired by this love that he had in his life. And then there's the Schumann quartet, which has the famous Clara motive, which was these two notes that he assigned to represent his wife that he incorporated into this piece. So there's that thread that brings these pieces together, and yet they're all very different from each other. So it's a romantic program, but each piece is quite unique. So that's another important factor that we look for.
Do you guys have different musical tastes, all of you?
Somewhat, but I think all of us agree on a large amount of the pieces. I mean, there's so many great pieces written for quartet. So a lot of times what people love to hear, these standards, these old kind of favorites, are some of our favorites too. So that overlaps nicely. And then, you know, pieces are being written for us, which is exciting. We can introduce audiences to that. And then also maybe some pieces that are lesser known to them. And probably some people like some pieces more than others within the quartet, but I think, you know, as a performer, we find the merits of it and try to make it the most convincing performance possible. So hopefully that's not obvious when we're on stage.
Yeah, because you're all performing, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, so Meg, you and Daniel are married. Mm-hmm. You're sisters with Liz. I feel like all of you together are like, it's kind of like, imagine like being in a family business. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you get inspiration or advice from other families. You all have been together for so long, for 15 years. How do you manage that? And how do you manage sort of a work-life balance for all of you guys?
Oh, yeah. It was a little bit of a circus sometimes, but I think you end up, when you're with a quartet, you're with them for so long anyway, they're sort of like family, whether or not they're related to you. So you might as well be family.
Right.
That's kind of the way I look at it. And we all have little kids around the same age. So I really like that we're sort of at the same stage of our lives, and we all have similar priorities, I think, as far as making sure we have time for our family. And, you know, we're not traveling so much that we can't be around for them. I think we all are very similar that way. I think it would be hard if we weren't, if maybe only one of us had kids and was trying to make that work. So we try to make a schedule that's doable. Sometimes the kids come with us, sometimes they don't.
I think over the 15 years we've found it's You know, we leave work at work.
And you've been able to do that?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. It took a lot of practice, and but, you know, issues that arise will get worked out, and usually it just takes a little bit of time when you're in a kind of an intense rehearsal setting or on tour. But the worst thing is to be trying to pay attention to your family and talking about, you know, something that happened during the day. It's just, we found that it's just better to kind of leave them separate, and we're happy that way.
And I imagine, like all performers, when you get on the stage, you probably forget about all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We kind of have a rule that no matter what happens in performance, we never get mad at each other about, you know, what happened on the stage, which I think is important. The worst we've had, maybe when we've played with other people, you know, afterwards they'll say rude things like, you know, you didn't follow me there or whatever. And I think that's just not any good. You have to feel like whatever happens on the stage, even if you make mistakes, it's okay.
Yeah, that's a real sacred space.
Because we'll all have our moments where we have a bad day and, you know, it gets passed around.
That's Liz Freivogel, Megan Freivogel, Nelson Lee, Daniel McDonough, the Jupiter String Quartet. They're performing this evening. Let's hear one last piece from them. Thanks to the Jupiter String Quartet for joining us today. And that's it. That's all the time we have. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether it's via phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. Special thanks today to Hala Delahi, who has been with us for the past 6 months as an intern. We're sad to see her go, but we're grateful for her help. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.